ان احنا ما كناش واقفين اصلا. اي مكان بنكون فيه احنا بيكون في ناس كتير ملمومين.
I'm Christopher Lydon, reflecting on 3 weeks in Cairo with my fellow podcaster Mark Fonseca Rondiro. We came out to sample Arab artists and writers on this ongoing revolution. We borrow from one of the best, Naguib Mahfouz, when we call this the coffee hour, where the whole family in Cairo sits around talking about what we're learning. Mark, get us started. What have you written in your diary?
Yes, well, first of all, I mean, we have to frame where we are now, which is the trip is over and we have to look back on it. And that affects already how I think you and I look back on it, how we write about it, how we even talk about it. Because here we are in the United States, in fact, and people are asking, what did you learn? What did you see? So there's a difference between, of course, being there and being home. First of all, there's what we thought going in, and we didn't really have a chance to talk too much about that. What you thought you were going to find when you got to Egypt, what people thought we were going to find. Of course, one of the criteria that immediately zooms us into a specific type of conversation is that we wanted to talk to artists. So you're not going to hear from the most simple peasant farmer, which perhaps would be interesting. You're not going to hear from a government worker, but you're going to hear from painters, you're going to hear from singers, you're going to hear from actors. And we did. So going into it, for me, I didn't know what to expect. I know some things based on previous travel. I know that if you hear that a country is on fire, it's unlikely to be exactly true. It's not always, you know, I've been to Kabul during a time of election struggles, violence, and people thought that the country was on fire and that there were bombs going off. And in much of the country, that wasn't the case, but that was the case in some places. So there we go to Egypt, and people have heard about demonstrations, and they say, you're going into trouble. So arriving in Egypt, I knew that it wasn't going to be the case that we're going to arrive and the whole thing is falling apart. But there were problems. I knew there would be problems, and we heard about them. But we also got to hear, and I knew that would happen as well, from hopeful voices, people working on stuff, on issues, on their own creativity, on their own art. So I am not, you know, I go into it knowing that we're going to get good and we're going to get bad, because that's what a country is made of. And that's certainly what Egypt is made of, the good and the bad. And I guess what people want to know is it more bad than good?
I want to say we got more than I ever thought we would. I mean, we had this impression of those revolutions, you know, leveling off, maybe sputtering out, and suddenly Tahrir Square was full again.
Yeah.
Second, Gaza, a few miles up the coast, was on fire under terrible bombardment by Israel.
Yeah. Yeah.
Further, this freak accident, but it had been predicted, of a train hitting a school bus, killing 50 children, which mortified that whole country.
Yeah.
And then there's Morsi, sort of getting credit for settling Gaza, but then asserting huge executive authority, maybe tyrannical authority, and then the Constitution deliberation sort of falling apart, and then the Constitution being ratified anyway, and Tahrir Square still in an uproar. So it was an experience I dreamed about. This is Victor Hugo in Paris in 1832, when the streets are full of barricades and warfare and revolution again. And I'd never experienced this before. I just want to say also, I mean, something I will tell my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren about is this electrical, incredible magic of Tahrir Square. People write about the clashes and all this stuff, but what you sense when you're walking among them is the incredible good nature, the sunny confidence, the fellowship, the experience, the know-how of people doing something that's never been done in my time, certainly not before my eyes. And there you were, you know, in among them.
Yeah.
I'm still sort of shaking with the excitement about it.
Right.
I want to come quickly, though, to this question, like, is it over? Is it
lost.
Back?
Yeah, yeah.
Is it going the direction of nice bourgeois Turkey, or is it going the wacko way of Iran? These questions are always in the street. A, nobody knows the answer, but B, to me, the moral is this thing is in some strange way that we can't predict from. It's amazingly alive.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazingly alive. It's alive in people's minds, in the art, despite Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood, and it could be a very, very repressive rule. There's an air of tremendous expressive freedom on every street we traveled.
And we really tapped into that, so we got a full blast of the creativity and the hope. Of course, there are people listening, maybe even some Egypt experts and reporters who spend much more time than we have there, which wouldn't take a lot of effort, you know, a little more than a month, and you're already ahead of us. Those guys probably say, but you're talking to the hope. If you go right to the hope, you're talking to the hope. Of course, we have to acknowledge there's the illiterate, there's the unheard of Egypt, a huge part of the country, which we, of course, don't get to meet. And
they are the ones that voted for the Constitution.
Yeah, so we fully acknowledge these people. We'll be reminded of them forever. Every time we smile about Egypt and tell a good story, which we have so many, including the Tahrir Square, which on the two glorious days that I remember best, a Tuesday, which was a sort of a rallying day after Morsi's statement, and then or that was Friday, and then the Tuesday where everybody said, come back to the square, today's the day, we're going to make a stand. And, you know, we go during the day, it's beautiful.
Sometimes.
We were there at night, but not late at night, and people spoke a lot about late at night and the differences, and I don't know, so even now, I don't know to say, yes, middle of the night is very different in Tahrir. Yeah, I guess the mood changes a little, you look around a little more, you're a little more careful, but that's also because historically, security forces attack at night. And that's another thing, you know, talking with Egyptians, even the non-artists, which we got to meet as well, some of them would say, don't go to the square. I don't know, Chris, maybe you shouldn't go to the square today. I would recommend you don't. And then on a lot of those occasions, we did go. You know, we took the risk, I guess, if it's a risk. But it turned out to be great. I even had a friend who said, I'm not going, and if I were you, I wouldn't go. And then we went, fantastic day. And that evening, the friend said to me, I heard you went, I went too, and I loved it. And the reason this happens is because people have mixed memories, of course, because so many people were killed, so many people were hurt. And we even had, one day, you and I were sitting in Café Riche, our favorite headquarters for Tahrir preparation and discussion. And a guy said, you know, the thing you may not realize as you walk from here to the square is that this zone, the avenues that lead to the square, they were the hardest part. Once you were in the square, you were safe. But it was the periphery where people were throwing rocks and waiting for you, the intellectual or the artist going to the revolution, to pelt you or to hurt you. And he said, it's so different now, because I can walk to that square from here. We can go right now. And we did. And so I always kept that in mind. You know, we had good days on the square, and I think there's a lot more good days on the square to be had, even now, despite what you see in the press, because I see so many negative images. But people remember when it was bad, and they're concerned, of course, that that could happen again. And there has been, you know, the presidential palace in the last few weeks, in front of that presidential palace, there have been street battles where people were killed and many, many were hurt.
Right.
So it's always possible, and that's what we were struggling with, even as visitors. We were struggling with our own fears, not knowing, not being sure, and then even Egyptians and their mixed take on what is possible, what is dangerous, what should be done, what's happened in the past. We had to sort of juggle with all of this. And I'd say it went well. Did we get lucky? I don't know that it was luck. I think that there is a lot of, like you said, positive, creative, kind, open-minded energy, in Cairo especially.
We could talk about Tahrir forever, and maybe we should stretch out a little bit more. A couple things. One, as you say, the mood today is festive. It's like a football game. It's like a Super Bowl. It's dangerous, and there will be fights in the stands, and somebody's going to get hurt. On the other hand, it's triumphal. And back at Café Riche, you know, there was a sort of afternoon pause in Tahrir, and all sorts of people gathered in this huge café where the great writers and singers and politicians and lawyers from time immemorial have gathered in Cairo. It was like sort of halftime at the opera.
Mm-hmm.
And people were seeing, being seen, commenting, I got a line, what did you hear? Did you tweet this? Blah, blah. It's triumphal. And by now they know how to do it. They've done it many, many times.
Yeah.
There's another piece of Tahrir, though, that I think we just have, that affected me. And that is simply people remembering, honestly, you know, it makes me very weepy. People talking about those days in January and February 2011 as a world moment. I mean, like the day of creation.
They do.
And it was dangerous. And it was mysterious. People still don't know why they went. No, I decided not to go.
Or why it worked.
And then my girlfriend said, no, you better be there, or why don't you? Come with me, or whatever. And they knew they were in danger of their lives, and they stood there, and they were ready to take it. and they were ready for the worst, and they ignited this sort of world miracle. And the other thing is, I think everybody we met knew somebody who'd suffered terribly.
Yeah.
I shot out, lost a brother, you know, a friend was hurt or is permanently damaged. One guy said to me on the edge of the square, with great feeling, he said, "I carried 40 dying or dead people out of this square 2 years ago." And he pointed, there was a tank, an army tank, there, right where we're standing, for a month.
Yeah.
And, I mean, this was like surviving Iwo Jima. Then he said, "But we survived,
mm-hmm.
and we won. It was a triumph."
Yeah.
It has a meaning for those people. I'm sorry to say that I was so late getting there,
mm-hmm.
but this is one of the historic markers of our whole world.
Yeah. I felt bad when we first went to... So there's the street that leads to Tahrir Square that has the most graffiti, and it's really a gallery of life these days. And so the walls are covered with fantastic graffiti that's been reported about heavily by all kinds of news outlets. And there we went. It was before the big protests sort of reignited. We went on a regular day of the week, took pictures of the wall. And as we were taking pictures, I already felt a little bit strange, like I was going somewhere that was sacred. I was taking pictures of graffiti that is of dead people. But I looked around and I saw cameras, even Egyptian news was there taking images. So I thought, okay, I think this is disrespectful. I feel disrespectful. I don't know if they feel disrespected. This is a strange thing because I'm impressed. I'm in awe. But like you say, I feel bad. I'm sad. I know I'm not mistaking the fact that a lot of people have suffered. I had a good time on these days. I learned a lot. I'm a bit of a tourist and a journalist. And that was a strange thing. You know, I met an Egyptian who said, "Oh, you went to Mohammed Mahmoud Street to see the graffiti. I won't go there. I remember the smell of blood." And if you go to that street now and you don't know what you're looking at, all you see is beautiful colors. I mean, you could just see beautiful colors.
Well, it's the vitality. You see beautiful colors painting the day after the faces of those children who died on the school bus. I mean... It's hard to say. There's no cheerful single headline about Egypt in this moment. On the other hand, there's going to be darkness, there'll be blood, there will be trouble before this revolution is over. At the same time, you're talking about the heart of a huge beast here, and it's pumping like crazy.
I want to talk about something that worries me about this revolution, and maybe it's for all those people who are listening going, "Ugh, could you not be so cheerful and so positive?" I'll give you something that I'm worried about and that I saw a lot of. You reminded me of it when you said that on the walls, the graffiti that was being added on one day that we were there were the dead children, faces of the dead children who died
in a
bus accident where a train hit a bus that, of course, should not have happened. These things should be functioning. So people were outraged, among other reasons. They knew that this was possible. And this government, in office for the months that it's in, didn't fix the problem. So they look at these children as victims, or, as we use the word, they use the word, martyrs of this revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And on they go to the wall. And these days, people who die, there's a lot of interpretations of, well, these people died as a result of a struggle that we need to continue. And so the children became martyrs, and they go on the wall, and they become an icon. And I'm worried about this. And the reason is, I think there's a danger where everything becomes sacred, becomes sacrament, becomes part of the revolution. It's the same thing, you know, you mentioned being in the cafe near the Tahrir Square, and people are all seen and being seen and writing their articles from there and taking photos. And I think that one of the bummers, I don't say bummers, that's a good academic word, of the time that we live in is that everything gets recorded and reported, and some things become world famous, sometimes deservingly so, because real change happened, and sometimes you spend so much time creating images and traditions and folklore that I don't know if we're not too busy doing that instead of making real change. So I'm worried that the revolution is too much of a religion rather than a process, or maybe those two things are inseparable. I don't know.
Too self-conscious. Too mediated.
Too look at me. Too you're a martyr, I'm a martyr. It shouldn't be so much about who is a martyr. It should be, you know, I'm worried. I'm worried about that outside of Egypt as well. We're all Every moment that we live is the turning point of the entire globe. Because we put it on Twitter, because it's out there, we took images of it, we remember it. You mentioned, you can interrupt me anytime, but you mentioned when people said, and a lot of the older guys in the cafe would talk about those 18 days in February 2011, the revolution. And when they talked about it, they would get misty-eyed. They would go, oh, those days. And like you say, I'm almost sad. You know, I'm definitely sad that I wasn't there, that it took so long to get there. But what they're also trying to do is recreate those days. Not everybody, but there are people who are trying to recreate those days. And I'm worried, you know, you can never recreate it. But never mind that. Move forward, create, and fight, you know.
But it's also their way of saying, Mark, I think that we're not going back. I mean, after that experience, no way are we stepping back into that world. I want to digress or spin off something you said about this whole question of talking to artists. It was a bit of a gimmick for me. I mean, in radio, we were always asking, wait a sec, what's Norman Mailer thinking about the Dodgers winning the World Series or anything, or the election of Bill Clinton? Or you're always thinking, you know, what would the great historical minds? We were always doing our radio saying, you know, where's Henry Steele Commager? Where's Samuel Eliot Morison when we need him to put this in perspective? So that's first an instinct, but it was also a gimmick to kind of get perspective. To me, the big joy and surprise of the whole trip was finding that somehow those artists are at the very core of it. A few examples. We've spoken of the paintings every day on that wall in Mahmoud Street. I mean, what's the news? Mm-hmm. You don't get it from a reporter. You get it from some artist who's defining a new image for the world. Okay. We interviewed this marvelous novelist, Ali Alaswani, of the Yacoubian Building. This is a writer. He's also a dentist. But he's also a guy who went on television, head-to-head, national television, with the prime minister, Shafiq, early in this SCAF time. And he wiped the floor with him. I mean, he's a political powerhouse, as you can't imagine anybody in our literature doing. But the point was, Shafiq resigned or was forced out of office the next day. You know, he just stared him down and said, and Shafiq said, this is unbearable. And Alaswani said, no, you're unbearable. And he said, you're not going to be the father of this country, which makes us children in our own country. They cross some lines rhetorically. Once you say those things and the people celebrate and the guy is gone, you don't go back. But furthermore, the real point I wanted to make is simply that these artists, I was afraid we'd find people sort of ripping off, rap songs from Los Angeles or Compton or the South Bronx, whatnot. What we discovered was that they're working off a deeply Egyptian tradition of painting first, but also wit, vernacular, poetry, new poetry. It was a Facebook revolution in many ways, but it's also profoundly out of their own history. And these devices, especially by the graffiti artists, which they will claim derived directly from, you know, the wall paintings of 5,000 years ago in a distinctly Egyptian tradition, are at the very, very core of it. Mm. And again, I think when people say, oh, it's going the way of Iran or it's over or whatnot, they're not accounting for the kind of creative surge every single day among people at the center. Here's the kernel of it for me. I came to think of Tahrir Square, I mean, the events of almost 2 years ago, as in themselves more like a work of art than anything else. It's sort of this moment of desperate insight. I think of something like Picasso's Guernica. It's not, you know, it's not a peaceful field, but it's this statement out of a kind of desperate imagination, blind fury and doubt and agony, and bang, let's go for it. We've done something, a stab in the dark, not by Picasso, but by a million people. In a square, we've made a statement for all time, and it's not exactly a political event. It's not exactly a birth or a death. It's kind of huge expression. I kept thinking, you know, what if a million goats had showed up in Tahrir Square, or a million earthworms, or a million Martians? You'd look out and you'd say, wait a sec, they're saying something. They're on to something. There was some collective notion in the species that something's got to be done. We're all hurting in many different ways under tyranny, in poverty, under environmental mortal threat to the planet, let's first say no to what's going on and then work hard on it. What do we call that except a kind of great work of art?
Yeah, and let's go to a different area than politics, or I mean, we're not sitting on politics, but revolution specifically, and go into individual lives. And that's something that you'll never get or not enough of in the international press, and that I try to say now that I'm home or in the West. And I'm not trying to sell this to people, but I think that they should be aware that life has changed for the individual. Maybe not every individual is exactly at the same place, definitely not financially, economically, but I'm talking about values, what's acceptable, what's possible. And what I learned and saw, and I'm sure we could see more of it to further hit home, is that for individuals in Egypt, life has changed. Mubarak fell, sure, but more importantly, you yourself, be you a street cleaner, or maybe one day a cop, but we'll see what happens with them, but a teacher, you suddenly realized, first of all, like you said, you're not the child, and that's the father down there, and he tells us whatever he wants us to do and be. Now, this government is supposed to work for us. Now, it may not want the job, and that's why these struggles continue, but people start to demand things. You know, while we were there, there was something we didn't exactly feel, but we heard so much about, and people kept telling us, there was a metro strike.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, we live in places where metro strikes happen. And for them, I think it was the first metro strike since the revolution and ever. There's no tradition of such a thing, at least not since the dictatorship days. And these kind of things where workers start to demand things, individual citizens start to say, I deserve X, I deserve rights. That's big. I mean, we met, and it's not all about the veil, but since people are so interested in things like veils, you know, one artist turned to me and said, I stopped wearing the veil last year.
Hmm.
And I didn't need to hear this. And I said, okay. You know, I was curious where she was going with this. And she said, yeah, and it's going pretty well. I feel good. And I said, okay. And it's not that the Egyptian revolution was about people taking off their veils. There's plenty of veiled women that are making their demands of life and country as well. But it was moments like this that I realized, yeah, Tahrir Square and the government, but look at the individuals. They're doing things. They're going into neighborhoods that were usually for the upper class, and they may not be able to afford to live there, but they're going to go hang out and sit on a corner, stand on a corner, go to the cafe that's still affordable nearby.
Drive their scooters through it, yeah.
Yeah, that was that great story someone gave us about how in Tahrir Square, people come from all different neighborhoods, and we saw a lot of that. And they would bring the music from their neighborhood, and someone from a different neighborhood, maybe upper class, lower class, would say, what is this music?
You don't belong here.
And they'd say, this is the music from our neighborhood. And suddenly, nowadays, that music has become, it's no longer isolated to one neighborhood. They're taking it everywhere. And people in even just a city are starting to know each other in ways they didn't before.
This is part of the riddle that confronted us at the beginning. People said a little defensively, no, the politics has not changed, the administration has not changed,
right.
The police are still the police, and
yeah.
Blah, the economy is still the economy, and it's worse. But you got to understand this is a cultural revolution. Okay, that's a loaded phrase. It'll take me years to figure out what that actually means. Are they just sort of saying, let us off the hook. We haven't got a revolution yet, but something's working. Something's working in the public culture. Something's also working in the private culture. People kept coming back to this. It's about fathers and children,
yeah.
Both female and male, and it's different.
And sad stories about, for example, street harassment, which is a topic that came up in our own programs, in our conversations, that women who walk the streets are constantly getting harassed by men, and it seems like there's no help. Nobody would come to the rescue or take a stand.
Yeah.
But just when you say something like that, at Tahrir Square, a place that is also notorious for harassment or has been, as we're leaving, I start to learn about, and now they're very present on Twitter and other places online, a group of men who have united and said, we are here to protect our women. We won't stand for street harassment. Here's our phone number. You can text us. We wear yellow vests. We wear yellow helmets. You'll recognize us on the square. We are clearly identified. And we are going to stand with you. We're going to be your bodyguards. Tahrir Bodyguards, I think this is something like their name. And look, is that going to reverse the tide of street harassment? No. But is that a sort of, we're not done yet, we're not just going to take this laying down anymore kind of sign? I think yes. Like, that's for me, that's like Egypt.
Right. That's what our friend, the anthropologist Fuad, meant when he talked about the innumerable microscopic events that are different now. Yeah. When somebody gets beat up in a police station, there's a crowd around that whole station in protest, you know, within hours or maybe minutes. These things don't go unnoticed. I just want to say, you know, I was kind of rattled this week that Chris Hedges, you know, everybody's favorite prophet of gloom and doom about everything, said it's over in Egypt. You know, they've gone the way of Iran. We've got a religious fanatics in power. They'll never give it up. I want to talk with Chris Hedges about this. I think he's got it wrong. He doesn't feel the deep participation in an act of complete rebellion that won, and the breadth in which that's sort of spread into the society. I found it curious also that Chris Hedges, who never gave up on Occupy Wall Street, has given up on an Egyptian revolution that's much, much broader and deeper and livelier. But we'll see.
Yeah, unfortunately, we live in this world, and we're doing a little bit of it right now, and I almost want to tell us to shut up, and everyone should stop listening. This need for people to explain, to categorize, to file it under success, failure, or some other category. Everything has to fit in these boxes. Egypt now, for all my friends who know me, I have to put it into some kind of box for them. And the truth is, and I don't know Chris Hedges from anyone else, but it's just not that simple. It's not, you know, you want to make a declaration and put a stamp on it, but it's simply not that easy. And that's not a bad thing, and it's not a good thing either. It's just life. It's complicated. It takes long. It's not over unless, you know, what year are we in? Is this the date when the Mayans said? And so I hate this need to put everything into categories.
Go ahead. Is
telling the stories. I'll tell you a few stories. Is this the story of the entire country? No. But I'll tell you a couple of stories about this country that I learned from people. You hear from the people yourself. And I don't think you can discount all of these voices. Like, this is Egypt, too.
I think you're giving us a cue to shut up before people stop listening. But let me just throw in closing, how many times did our friends, yours and mine and different people, write or say, be safe, be safe. I'm worried about you going there. You know, do you know people get kidnapped in Cairo and all of this kind of stuff? I didn't know whether we would be free to record outside in public markets in Tahrir Square. And I just got a note, not one cross look in 3 weeks in Cairo with a Radio Open Source T-shirt that said, here to listen on the back.
I was not that brave. I wore it indoors.
No, but people were friendly. I'm thinking of the juice guy on the street around the corner who wanted to have a picture taken with us.
You.
We still owe him that picture.
Yeah,
but how many people said, welcome to Egypt?
Yeah.
How many people looked at you with this? It's not childish innocence, but with a kind of world-weary tolerance and experience, and say, welcome to Egypt.
Yeah. It's the be safe chant, and people mean well, but I'd rather hear something else. I'd rather hear people say, tell me about it, or enjoy, because there's so much to be enjoyed in that country. Even in a time of struggle, you can see great beauty. And this whole be safe thing goes back to the fact that despite all the tools we have for communication, all the ways to speak directly to an Egyptian who speaks your language, whatever language you speak, you'll find an Egyptian surely publishing these days in your language, who could tell you what's going on in the country, different stories of what's going on.
Yeah.
We still boil it down to it's either safe or unsafe. They either hate us or they love us. And the presumption, especially in the United States, is that Egypt these days hates us. Because, well, they've got this government, they hate America, and they voted for them, so the people who voted, they must hate America. And it's so, first of all, it's much more complicated than that, and to put it real mildly, they separate between people and a government, goes for America, that goes for the world. They know what it's like to live under a government that does things they don't agree with.
And how many people told us flatly, very unmistakably, we love the American people? And we hate, we despise, we loathe, we've suffered under the American government.
Whoever's in charge.
Right, and they make no bones about it.
Yeah.
Last thought for me, Mark, is simply when you say, we can love Egypt. I came away feeling this revolution, this experience they're going through, this doubt, this fear, this anxiety about their own environment, their anxiety about tyranny, their anxiety about a neoliberal rule of economy around the world is also us. It's our story. Mm. This is not, you're not going very far afield when you go to Egypt and you see the deep, deep fundamental distress of all the world systems and maybe an example of how to get out of them.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think there's a lot. The trick is, how do we get the rest of the world to see this? I'm not trying to convince people necessarily, but to understand the connections, both direct through money and in governments and families, but also just the connections as people, humans on the planet, who have so many common roots. I mean, we learn so much about the multiculturalism of Egypt. And, you know, if you trace your roots far back enough, you may end up in Egypt. But we don't know this. You know, I'm Portuguese, and there's this assumption in Portugal that what do we have to do with North Africa? We have everything to do with North Africa. But it's been sort of buried. It's not a popular topic. It's difficult. Maybe it's complicated. Some uncomfortable feelings for whatever reason. But my conclusion on Egypt is I was amongst family. And I realize a lot of the world doesn't agree. And I'm just going to keep on telling people why I think I was amongst family and people I could relate to and a struggle that doesn't seem so alien to me.
Amen. Amen.
So that's it for us, I think, for the the Arab Artists in a Revolution series. I mean, we've got the stuff up on radioopensource.org.
We've got a lot of stuff in the pipeline that we haven't finished editing yet, so there's more to come.
Yeah, and I've got also a few side interviews on citizenreporter.org, and there's photos. We'll link to all this so people can relive the joy, as we seem to do. We go back and and still learn from what we experienced.
Mark Rendero, it was a pleasure traveling with you. It's a pleasure talking with you. Let's do it again.
Yes, let's. يلا أصوات وإلى كلام العباقرة وشغل الأباترة إحنا المؤسسين من أيام الفراعنة واللي مش عاجبه الكلام يتفضل من هنا طالما عديت ما لقيتش زحمة تعرف إن إحنا ما كناش واقفين أصلا أي مكان بنكون فيه إحنا بيكون في ناس كتير ملمومين طالما عديت ما لقيتش زحمة تعرف إن إحنا ما كناش واقفين أصلا أي مكان بنكون فيه إحنا في ناس كتير ملمومين